ימים יוצרו ולא אחד בהם. Many days have been created, but one day is especially his. Tradition relates this text from the Book of Psalms to the Atonement Day. Yom Kippur is Hayom, the day, an occasion of unique spiritual significance. Yom Kippur is that moment of most intimate and precious contact between God and Israel. To use the picturesque language of our mystical tradition, year-long man seeks to raise himself up. On Yom Kippur, God bends down and comes close to the struggling man. Yamim Yutzaru, Lo Echad Bohem. Many days have been created, but one day is uniquely his. Every year, some weary expatriates are drawn back to the congregation of Israel on Yom Kippur. Their habits, their interests have taken them to faraway places and to far-out philosophies. But they have returned, and this unique day has drawn them home. Why do they come? Why do we come? I suspect that we could not parse down and scalpel all of our motives, but this much is clear. Yom Kippur is a gripping spiritual magnet. There is a melody, a liturgy, a beauty here which is unsurpassed, touching. There is a message bound into this day which is universal and basic. There is a judgment here, humbling, yet necessary and helpful. And here is a promise, a pardon, encouraging, giving us the spirit to carry on. Yom Kippur is uniquely his and uniquely ours. I know of no other religious occasion which has the capacity to move us so profoundly and into which the centuries have placed so much profound wisdom. And I would suggest that we seek to unfold some of that wisdom together this evening. Note, if you will, the structure of this day's service. We will not rise to speak our statement of creed until late tomorrow, at Ne'ilah time, when the gates are about to be closed. We will rise in our pews and repeat the abiding pledges and formulae of our tradition. And the final phrase of our worship will be the simple affirmation, "The Lord, He is God." Three times we will say it. Adonai Hu Elohim, the Lord, He is God. And then the shofar will be sounded, and the worship of our Atonement Day will have ended. Now, God is present in every act of our worship. The divine is refracted in all that we do on this holiest of days, yet we delay the statement of creed until the final moment of our worship. Why? To teach us that faith does not emerge fully blown. Faith is an achievement, not a native endowment. Belief is the culmination of a religious life and not its prelude. You ought not to feel an alien here, a stranger among us, awkward and shy, because some things are theologically unclear to you, because you have doubts and reservations. When our people asked their mystical leader centuries ago for guidance in the quest for God, they were told, imagine faith as a ladder. There are many rungs a man must climb on a ladder until he reaches the top. There are many deeds and duties and devotions and disciplines which a man must mount before he comes to the heavens, the living presence of God. In an age of explosive living, in an age of exploding knowledge, we ought not to be ashamed of our doubts. To live is to doubt. Only the ignorant are unshaken. Faith emerges, grows upon us, is born out of our experience. It is not suddenly placed upon us, given to us by the heavens. Let me tell you of the Epicurus of Tarnopol. Epicurus is a Yiddish corruption of the word Epicurean, which refers to that group of existentialist Greek philosophers of centuries ago. In Jewish life, an Epicurus was one who challenged the teachings, the theology of the tradition. Now in Tarnopol, there was only a single Epicurus, Reb Moshe. And Reb Moshe lived a lonely life. He had no one with whom to share the pleasure of a well-built argument which punctured some claim of the faithful. He wanted the companionship of a skeptic. But there was none. And then one day, a traveler told him that in the capital, there was a very famous skeptic, Reb Yitzchak, the Epicurus of Warsaw. And no sooner did he hear of the great and famous Epicurus of Warsaw, who had debated the most important and pious scholars of the day and held his own, than Reb Moshe packed his bag and off he went to Warsaw. And he came to the capital on a Sabbath and he asked for the home of Reb Yitzchak, the famous Epicurus of the city. And the passerby said, I can direct you to his home, but he's not at home, he's in the synagogue. But the little Epicurus of Tarnopol could not believe his ears. What was the great and famous skeptic doing in the synagogue? But he had no other information, so he presented himself to the shamus of the synagogue. And he said to him, kind sir, I'm sure I've been sent here by a good bit of misinformation, but tell me, where can I find the Epicurus of Warsaw? Well, he's inside. But you can't speak to him now because he's the Baal Korah today. He's reading the Torah to the congregation. The little skeptic's world was falling all about him. The great Epicurus of Warsaw in the synagogue, reading the Torah to the congregation, what was he to make of it? He paced up and down, distraught and in frenzy, waiting for the service to end. The service ended. And the Epicurus of Warsaw appeared, and the little man of Tarnopol raced up to him and without introduction grabbed him by the shirt front and said, are you still a doubter? Are you still a skeptic? And he said, yes, I am the Epicurus of Warsaw. Well, what are you doing in the synagogue? How can you be reading the Torah to the congregation? Dear friend, don't you ever go to your synagogue? What's the synagogue to me and what am I to the synagogue? I'm an Epicurus. You're not an Epicurus, came the reply. You're a nar, a fool. Only a fool would deafen his ears to 3,000 years of experience and of teaching. Only a fool would deny that in every valuable and wise tradition there is something that can be learned. Only a fool would be so sure of himself that he would never change his mind, that he would be frightened to enter the door and experience the teaching of his people. The only initiation pledge that Judaism, that Yom Kippur requires, is an honest question of concern. What is demanded of me and by whom? Where am I leading and going in my life? Why? If you ask that question honestly, you belong here, and that is the teaching of the Kol Nidre. For what is the Kol Nidre? We hear it sung, but we cannot translate the Aramaic. It's wrapped in a melody which moves us with its grace. We think of it as one of the classic poems of the soul, but it's nothing of the kind. The Kol Nidre is a musty and pedestrian legal document, a judicial statement of quittance, of pledges made under duress. It was devised some 12 centuries ago by Jews who had been forced to the baptismal fount at the sword's point. This was their rite of purgation, their statement that once a year, somehow, in some way, despite the danger, they would speak again in the traditions of their people and sing again the songs of their people and worship again with the prayers of their people. And so they crept into attics, down into cellars, behind locked doors. There they recited the Kol Nidre. There they intoned the prayers of this holy day. Now, religious coercion is out of style. But there are many who are coerced in our world, millions who are coerced in our world to profess ideologies with which they do not agree. What is the great purge in China but a bloody Marxist baptism? Just today we read of an author in Yugoslavia sentenced to prison for failing to toe the party line. And in South Africa, a man is ostracized, excommunicated, bankrupt for speaking of racial justice. And though unofficially, these same pressures and these same acts take place, do they not, in many cities of our own nation? Life is cruel. Life often forces us to become someone we do not and did not want to be. The soldier must become a predatory beast, prepared to kill without compunction. And there are many, perhaps many sitting here, who believe that to survive in the marketplace, they must become shrewd and cold-hearted, conniving. And how many of us choke back our most cherished principles lest they offend an opinionated employer or bar our way to acceptance into some group in which we desire to belong. There are many in our world who must say the Kol Nidre, as did our fathers long ago, privately and hidden. The Kol Nidre, or some such formula, is the formula of their decency, of their humanity. It gives them their freedom. It helps them to survive. But most of us are rather like the Jews who, through the century, came to the baptismal fount voluntarily, if not, but not willingly. Fear brought us there. Physical fear for our lives or for the lives of our children. Fear for our livelihoods, fear for our possessions, fear for our position, fear of exile, fear of torture, fear of affliction. Whatever the reason, throughout the centuries, under pressure, under fear, Jews professed loyalties in which they did not believe. Now, the Kol Nidre can be said surreptitiously by those who are hidden. But of those of us who live in a free land, the Kol Nidre must be said publicly. We must openly join the congregation of the forthright. For I'm afraid that timidity is the besetting sin of man. Our fears far outrace, do they not, the reality. We build paper tigers. We cower afraid of them. We can invent, for we are ingenious and clever, 1,000 rationalizations and every excuse for every ignominious and cowardly act. Kol Nidre demands the very minimum, that we publicly come, that we sense the shabbiness and the second-rate quality of these lives of calculation and pretense, and that we place ourselves openly in the sunshine, not in the shadow world, but in the sunshine, ready to receive a teaching, a principle that is first rate and of the divine quality. But But it is not enough simply to be ashamed, simply to want it, something better. I know of many, as you do, too, who bathe themselves annually in remorse, but do not manage at all to clean up their lives. Our age rather delights in wallowing in contrition. We strip ourselves of our illusion, our literature, our psychology, all of this tells us how to do it, but we don't seem to be able to bring ourselves up out of the slime. Herzog is the symbol of the modern man. He's utterly without illusion, without pretense, full of remorse and contrition. He beats his breast constantly, does he not? But he hasn't the willpower to bring himself out of the swamp of rot and of weakness. Where do we find this willpower? Where do we find that psychic power which will allow us to break free of the ties of cowardice and convenience and comfort and conformity and break out so that we can come into our full stature and lead lives such as we know we are capable of leading lives which will please God and please the soul within? Where do we find such willpower? Here again, the Kol Nidre is helpful, the Yom Kippur is helpful and suggestive. For Yom Kippur is not only a teaching, Yom Kippur is a terror. And Yom Kippur, we are forced to face death, our own mortality, the impermanence of security, the fact that suddenly the world can open us beneath us and swallow us whole. On Yom Kippur, our ancestors wore the shrouds in which they would be buried. On Yom Kippur, you and I recite in every service the only truly frightening prayer in our entire book of prayers. We ask God to scrape from our eyes the blindness of our illusions, to break the rose-colored glasses which we put upon ourselves, to make us see the world as it really is, cruel, insecure, raw, violent. V'chein tein pachtecha adonai Eloheinu al kol ma'asecha, v'imascha al kol ma shebarasa. Therefore, allow thy dread, O Lord, to become palpable to all thy creatures, and the reality of thy fear, let it be upon all whom thou hast created. Lethargy is born in the comfortable lie that there will be a tomorrow. That there will be a tomorrow, and that the tomorrow will be woven of the same happy stuff as today. As long as we can say to ourselves, yes, I'll volunteer and I'll be active in my city when I retire, assuming that we will live that long. As long as we can say to ourselves, yes, I'll go back to my skills, to my reading, to my art when I have raised my children, assuming we'll have the health and the time and the occasion. As long as we can say to ourselves, I'll stop driving myself and give myself time to be with my family when I have made them financially secure, assuming that that time will ever come. As long as we assume that there is a tomorrow, and that tomorrow is woven of golden stuff, so long will we make resolutions on Yom Kippur and break them the very next day. Saints, my friends, run scared. The medieval artists quite appropriately placed in the canvas portraits of their saints a skull. The saint lived in the presence of death, and he was determined to compress into every moment a lifetime of meaning, to push into every day every ounce of spiritual energy of service, every opportunity which he could. Everything about this great day reflects this theme of the looming presence of death, the whiteness of the altar, the fasting, the law that we afflict our soul, the constant reference to the fleeting passage of time, the legend which makes this day into a day of ultimate judgment, as our prayers say, of who shall live and who shall die, whose time shall be fulfilled and who will die before his time, who will be secure and who will be distraught, who will be serene and who will be broken, who will be raised up and who will be brought low. Death raises a fury within us, which makes us strike out to fight for life, and once we have gained a day, to make full use of the moment. Dostoevsky was once sentenced to death, and he was reprieved before the sentence could be carried out. He placed his own impressions, his own feelings during this terrifying episode into the life of one of his characters in the story The Idiot, a certain Prince Mishkin. The prince is sentenced to death. He is brought to the scaffold. There the sentence is read to him. He is made to climb up the gallows. He is made to stand there for 20 minutes while the preparations are completed, and then at the last moment, a statement of reprieve is read. Here is Dostoevsky commenting on Dostoevsky. He told me that these minutes seemed to him an infinite time, a vast wealth. But he said that nothing was so dreadful as a continual thought, what if I were not to die? What if I could go back to life? What eternity? It would all of it be mine. I would turn every minute into an age. I would lose nothing. I would count every minute as it passed. I would not waste one. He said that this thought turned to such a fury that he longed to be shot quickly. Only the fury of being mortal can give us the power to take hold of our lives and to exchange the shoddy for the first rate. But fury alone is blind. And there are many who are condemned who spend their last hours and days in a desperate attempt to gulp down the passions and the excitements of life. The soldier on his last leave, when he has been condemned to battle, spends it seeking precisely such a passion. Yom Kippur here again is suggestive and helpful, for it reminds us that the greatest adventure of life is the search within. The greatest opportunity of life is to unfold the person that we have the opportunity to become. The greatest joy in life is living up to that still small voice within which tells us, man, thou art a son of God. There is divinity here. Allow the flame to flare up. Allow yourself to feel. Allow yourself to reach to the heights. Allow yourself to be a son of God. Man, on Yom Kippur, is brought face to face with himself. Yom Kippur is the day of confession. Here is the man, here is the measure. The confession is public. We write our own commentary. Each of us reads his own life into the line. Each of us asks himself the terrible questions. Where in this satisfied and secure head of a family is that young hero who was so passionately concerned with injustice, who was determined to go out and fight for human decency? Where in this rather hard and calculating woman is the little child who cradled her doll in her arms? Where is the doctor who dreamed of healing? Where is the lawyer who dreamed of justice? Where is the professor who dreamed of teaching, and that competent technician who has no time to listen and hardly knows the names of his clients and of his students? Each of us is two. The person we are, the person we might have been and still can become. And Yom Kippur says to us very simply, you haven't got the time to live a double life. Now, pleasure can be bought, and wine can be paid for, and song can be purchased. It's not easy to live a gay life. All you need is a bankroll and enough aspirin. It's difficult to live a good life. It takes courage, it takes wisdom, it takes conviction, it takes tenacity, it requires daring, it requires the use of every strength that we have within. Man, you know, is born animal. There's no trick to remain an animal. The trick is to become a man. The trick is to explore yourself, to break loose of your fears, to become sensitive and thoughtful and sympathetic and passionate about those things which count and concerned with the fate of your fellow mortal and able to love and not only to lust. That's the accomplishment, to become a man. And that, by the way, my friends, is the greatest joy any of us can have in life, to come into ourselves. We have come full cycle. Yom Kippur is a very personal and private moment. Yom Kippur breaks loose the deep thoughts within. We become restless. We begin to think despite our careful defense mechanisms. We begin to unearth the deep concerns and the feelings that we have somehow placed year-long beneath a layer of worldliness and worldly sophistication. The heart begins to quiver, to pulsate, to feel, to break down the envelope of insensitivity in which we have so carefully placed it, lest the still small voice speak out year long and remind us, not that way, but this. A strange thing happens on Yom Kippur. By Ne'ilah time, at the closing of the gates, we can say with a whole heart, the Lord, He is God. How have we come to this faith? Very simply. As we have looked within, as the heart of stone has become a heart of flesh, somehow it has found a new encouragement, has been flooded with a feeling, yes, I can do it. And where comes this strength, if not from God? And in Yom Kippur, even when we are down in the depths of remorse and contrition, we sense the dignity with which we are sculpted and created and made, and the world becomes again attractive, not only a hapless routine, but God's creation. Year long, we shuffle along, burdened with guilt, convinced that we lack the power to break loose of the past, of the shackle of our habits. And in Yom Kippur, suddenly it becomes very clear to us, we're freed of our burdens. We're loose. We can. The ancients said simply, God has pardoned. We say more scientifically, we find new stores of psychic power within, but whence these stores if not from God? Yom Kippur is a day of search, contrition, correction, of remorse and of resolution. It is also a great day of faith. The two are intertwined, for faith grows out of our experience. Faith is the culmination of a religious life and not its prelude. A teacher interrupted his lecture to ask the class question. Where, he said, does God dwell? And the young seminarians, knowing a text or two, were quick to answer, "The whole earth is full of his glory." The teacher did not deny what they had said, but he opened to them a new dimension of meaning. God, he said, dwells wherever man will let him in. The new heart that we seek on Yom Kippur can let God in. This is the day of faith. This is the day of growth. This is the day of search. By the end of this day, we stand in our places, taller than we have stood before, and more wholehearted in our faith. Yomim Yutzaru, V'lo Echad Bachem. Many days have been created, but this day is uniquely his. And I submit to you that on this day, we draw close to him.